First of all, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity of presenting our work here. I will be talking about this paper, which came out in August this year. This is joint work together with Flaminia, who is here, Czaslaw, who is here, and Alessio Belenkia, who is not here. And so this talk or this work has a lot in common with many of the talks already given here. It is related to Flaminia's talk in the sense that we're going to be talking about quantum reference frames or some instance of quantum reference frames for time in this case. It has a lot to do with Ognian's talk in the sense that we're going to be looking at some sort of delocalization of events with respect to a certain notion of time. And it also has a lot to do with Alex's talk because we're going to be using this timeless formulation. And it has to do with Lucian's talk because we're going to be looking at different representation and changes of temporal frames. So it is about the notion of events and time evolution in physical situations that we're not used to, in physical situations that go a bit far from our common understanding of physical theories, in the sense that we're going to be looking at these notions in context with the metric field of space-time is not well-defined, but is rather affected by some quantum systems that we can that gravitate and that we can put in superposition. And the question of this will be, so what are the new features relating these concepts of events, time evolution, etc., and what features are still present or are conserved in this kind of new situation? So I will first talk about events. This is just to argue how important or how all that we say about space-time distances and relations between events and so on, how important the notion of having a fixed metric background is. And then I will present some thought experiment of some very concrete situation in which we would expect this metric field not to be actually well-defined. So in order to pose a problem, and then I would like to propose a method to deal with some of these situations. So this is a conference on quantum causality. We're very used to diagrams that look like this. We can say in some sense all these boxes A, B, C, and D represent events, by which I mean something that happens to a quantum system. Could be a unitary operation, it could be a CP map, anything that we perform to a quantum system. And these events are wired together, and the possibility of one event to influence causally what happens in a different event is given by the wiring between them. And of course, we would like to link this abstract picture with a notion of space and time in which events are some sort of points on a manifold. And what gives us the possibility of signaling are the light cones that stem from these events. Here, for example, A cannot signal to D, but can signal to D, but not to C, because D is within the light cone arising from event A, but C is not. And already here we see that in order to talk about light cones, to talk about space-like or time-like separations, it is fundamental that we have a well-defined notion of a metric. And well, this is pretty fundamental, and pretty basic as well. What is even more, we can operationally define a notion of distance between two events along a certain curve by really putting some observer that moves along this trajectory and carries a clock, and by reading the clock from the event A to the event D, we start the clock at event A and we stop it at event D, and we say, okay, this is the distance between these two events according to this trajectory. When I talk about events, I don't mean merely points. I really mean what was inside the box, somehow some notion of something happening to a system, which I depict here by say the interaction between this blue system, which is a system of interest, and perhaps some other ancilla or device which records some information on the blue system. And given that plus the reading of the clock, this will be kind of my notion of event, something that happens to the system given that the clock measures 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, etc. This will be the event A and this will be the event D. Of course, in order for us to measure this distance again, we need a well-defined definite metric, a well-defined space-time metric so that the clock ticks according to its proper time given by the metric. So of course, this is very important if we want to calculate probabilities for things to happen. It relies fundamentally on the fact that things are space-like, time-like separated, and the distance between the events. Now we'll talk a little bit about situations, concrete ones, in which we would expect this metric to be indefinite. There's many examples of this, but I chose this one in particular because it has to do with the notion of measuring time. When we measure time, we use a clock. Clocks are physical systems. They have energy, they have position, etc. And in particular, they have to be systems which are in superposition of energies. If this were not the case, then the clocks would be stationary and we cannot use them. We could not use them to define what we mean by time evolution or something changing. So this is a very rudimentary example of what I mean by a clock. It's just, say, a qubit in a superposition between two energy levels with respect to some Hamiltonian. And then we start the clock in this initial state, and we ask the question, when does the clock change? When does this plus become a minus? So that we're certain to find the clock in a different state, and we define this to be our time step, or we are certain that something changed, that one kind of instant of time has passed. What gives us the accuracy or the precision? I always get confused between these two, but of this clock, this will be, or how thinly we can slice our timeline when we have this instrument to measure time. It will depend, of course, on how fast it undergoes this transition from plus to minus. And this turns out to be given by this time called the orthogonalization time. This is a purely quantum mechanical consideration, and what is important about it here is that it's inversely proportional to the energy gap of the Hamiltonian. So if we want to measure time very precisely, we need to invest a lot of energy. This is just quantum mechanics, but once we put general relativity into the ingredients, this becomes more interesting because we know that this energy gravitates, and we know that if we put a clock in a superposition of energies, how this clock gravitates is actually not well defined. So we can imagine a tremendously accurate clock and ask what is the gravitational field in its vicinity. So the clock is in a superposition between E0 and E1. This means that the gravitational field in this vicinity is in some kind of superposition between that gravitational field corresponding to E0 and the one corresponding to E1. So this is already an instance of a metric field which is not well defined. And this has important kind of operational consequences. In particular, if one thinks about a different clock which is located in the vicinity of the very precise one, and asks, how would this clock tick? On the one hand, one can think, OK, it ticks according to the energy E0 with a relatively slow, fast time dilation. Or if the clock were in the energy E1, it would tick slower because the mass would be bigger. But it turns out that the clock is neither in its E0 nor in its E1. It is in a superposition between the two. And therefore, this clock gets confused, so to say, doesn't know precisely what to tick. And then we reach some sort of fundamental uncertainty in our capability of measuring time. The more precise we want to measure time here, the price to pay is that this clock will get more and more confused, and the less precise the measurement of time is in the location of the other clock. Of course, this is, and this will be very important for the remaining of the talk. This is the picture that somebody using these two clocks from yet an external perspective, this is the story that this person would tell about the ability of defining time evolution using these clocks as instruments. Okay, so this is just mathematically what I said. This can be modeled by some very simple interaction between the clocks. This interaction takes place with respect to the reference frame of the external guy who uses the Hamiltonian to evolve the clock's state according to their time, and concludes that the clocks will get entangled, so that when I go and measure one of the clocks, I will find the clock in a mixed state and will just give me relatively random answers. In other words, it's no longer a good clock to define the passing of time. More in general, this points to kind of a key question or the key difficulty, which is when we have gravitating quantum systems, how do we define the passing of time? Or we want to evolve, we want to apply the Schrodinger equation in order to compute probabilities, to compute the evolution and ultimately probabilities of things to happen. What is this dvt if we don't have clocks that would track this this dvt? This is the question, and what follows is some sort of proposal of toy models to deal with this situation and to ask what happens to this notion of event, what happens to this notion of time evolution when one has these sort of situations involving gravitating quantum systems. So the kind of philosophy we're taking here is, okay, maybe the metric might not be well defined, but the clock is still there. And one can still use these operational procedures of defining events with respect to clocks, et cetera, in order to make sense out of what we mean by events, time evolution, et cetera. So this is the part where this is just a proposal of one way how we could do it, which is using this Page and Wouters or timeless approach. There might be other ways to do it, but this is how we did it here. So I was fortunate that Alex and Czaslaw already introduced this formalism before, so I will not have to go into the details. It's basically, it postulates that there is a state which is annihilated by a constraint. This state contains the physics of the history of a certain systems, the relations between these two systems, which we can then decompose in a way that one of the subsystems acts as a clock and describes the rest of the systems as evolving in time with respect to the time measured by this clock. So in this case, I have four clocks and a system, and I can take, for example, the perspective of clock number three, and then when I solve the constraint equation that I put above in the previous slide, I will be able to write down a state that looks like this. Which what this means is there's a correlation between the time read by clock three and the state of the rest of the system, which I denote by three with a bar on top, given that the time showed by clock three is t. So, and as you see, when one solves this constraint, one can cast it in a way in which we have t on this side and then a unitary evolution acting on some initial state. And this unitary evolution will be the evolution of the system, clock one, clock two, and clock four. This will involve free evolution, let's say, possible interactions between systems and clocks, possible measurements as well, etc. So we can do this with respect to clock three, but of course nothing stops us from doing it with respect to clock two, in which case we would have a state like this, and our goal is to compare these two states to find a transformation between this representation and the previous one, and to investigate what happens to the notion of events when we switch between these two perspectives.
So yeah, in that expression you have T2, so is that the state of clock two, or the state of clock two not? Like, is the Hilbert space of clock two not in this description? So here you see in the top picture, like,
yeah, so,
outside. And
so this is the Hilbert space of clock two,
okay. And
this is the state of the rest of the world as seen by clock two.
Okay, good. Yeah, so that bottom side actually would have all the clocks in it.
In this expression, there are all the clocks contained, but in this clock two plays a special role because it's
factored.
Yes, exactly. So there seems to be, I started this talk or this motivation by telling you, okay, clocks will fundamentally get entangled and will lose their ability to operationally define what a time step is. And then I'm telling you that I will jump between clocks, and these clocks will see time evolution, which is unitary with respect to them. So there seems to be some sort of tension, because if a clock kind of decoheres, how can it be that this clock describes a time evolution? So what happens with this tension, and how can we resolve it? And so the key observation here is that these two clocks are entangled with respect to the perspective of yet another observer who has their own time and describes this time to and uses this time to describe the evolution in which these clocks get entangled. This doesn't mean that when we jump into the frame of the clock that gets entangled from the perspective of the external guy, they will see this decoherence. In order to be more clear, let me make a bit of a detour and make an analogy with the case of spatial reference frames. This was explained by Flaminia in her talk. I'm just going to remember it here because it's important. It's easier to understand the case for space. So suppose we have something like this. Suppose we have Alice, the blue particle. We have Bob, the red one. And we have Charlie, that is maybe me or somebody describing this state between Alice and Bob. So Charlie writes down this state, which has two amplitudes. And in each of these two say branches, the distance between, the relative distance between Alice and Bob is always the same. But the state is entangled because we have one amplitude in which is shifted to the left and one amplitude which is shifted to the right. So it is this state here. And then we ask the question, how would Alice, the blue particle, would see the red one? And then naively one could think, okay, if we trace out Alice, we see that the red particle is left in a mixed state. So Alice would say that Bob is left in a mixed state. But this is not the case, because what Alice can see is mainly the relative distance of Bob with respect to her. And if we take this into account and jump into Alice's frame, what we will see is that actually Bob is in a pure state given by position delta with respect to Alice. This can be made more precise, of course, if one uses these transformations between spatial reference frames that are given in this paper here. This is just to say it's not surprising, the case of the clocks, that they might seem entangled from one perspective, but once when we jump to the perspective of each of these clocks, the clocks will still be able to describe some unitary evolution. So now I will try to really explain what we did in terms of events, their temporal localization or localizability, etc. So as Czaslaw explained in his talk, a way of dealing with measurements in this Page-Wouters formalism is to include a purification of them into the initial constraint. And this is important because if we were go and apply the collapse postulate to the, say, history state, we run the risk of applying it and then taking the state outside of the constraint subspace. So a way out of this is to simply describe all measurements already incorporated within the constraint. And so I'm going to use this kind of procedure of measuring things and evolving clocks to kind of map out what we mean by events and to kind of figure out the relative localization of events in space-time. So the main idea is Alice has an ancilla, a system, and a clock. She prepares an initial state or an initial laboratory situation in which the clock triggers an interaction between the system and ancilla. This is captured by this FA of TA condition on her clock measuring some time, some TA star. And we will mean by this interaction or by this operation that is done on the system with the help of the ancilla, we will call this an event and we will denote it by this red star. And then Bob does the same. And then they repeat the experiment many times and they, in this way, by measuring the clocks and systems and the outcome results and so on, they will be able to do a map of the relative location of the events that looks like this. They will draw some sort of surface, and they will see that the event of Bob takes place here, at this coordinate with respect to the operationally defined time by Bob, which might be different to the one defined by Alice, and they will do the same and map out the same operation for Alice's event. They compare their data and they draw a picture like this. In this case, what is important is that from both Alice's and Bob's perspective, the start happens, say, at a given point. Each of them are completely localizable with respect to both Alice and Bob temporal reference frames. As we will see, this is in general not the case when one includes interactions between the clocks. So let's consider that the first case we consider in this paper is very, just to warm up a little bit, is a constraint like this, which is the one that I explained before. The two clocks evolve naturally. For simplicity, we were taking this HA and TA, HB and TB to be canonically conjugate pairs. So what this expression means is the clocks will evolve freely without interacting with each other, and there will be some operation done on the system triggered by the clock measuring TA or triggered by the clock measuring TB. And we want to locate these operations in time. So what we do is we solve this. We can solve it, and there's many ways of solving it. If you're interested in kind of the technical details, I can talk about it later, but for the time being, I will just say there is some procedure to do this, and there is moreover some procedure to cast the solution in terms of jumping into the reference frame of either A or B. So now I will explain what happens if we change with respect to if we jump or if we express the solution in a representation in which A maps the event according to her time. So most of this equation is unimportant for what I want to say. What is important is this F, what happens with this F, which monitors when the event is applied. So as we see, we have two events. We have the event of Alice, and we have the event of Bob. One is triggered by this FA, and one is triggered by this FB. We see that FA, the argument of FA, is merely a parameter. It's merely a C number. It's not quantum in any way. This means that precisely when this S takes the value TA star, the event will happen, and it will be sharply localized with respect to this time. On the other hand, the event of Bob depends on S, but it also depends on the time operator of Bob. This means that there will be some uncertainty if we prepare this initial state with some width. There will be some uncertainty, according to Alice, as to when the event of Bob occurs, because this TB will not take a sharp, precise value in general, but rather will have many different corresponding to different amplitudes of the initial state. So what we see in pictures is basically this. In Alice's perspective, the event of Alice happens sharply, whereas the event of Bob happens with certain with some uncertainty sigma given by the uncertainty of the initial state with which we prepare the clock. If we cast the history state in terms of Bob instead of Alice, we will see that the opposite happens. So for Bob, it will be his state, the one which is precisely localized in time, whereas Alice's will have some uncertainty. This is, of course, because we chose our clock to be bad in the beginning. If it's a bad clock, we will have this kind of effect. In this Hamiltonian that I wrote, or in this constraint, there is the possibility of choosing clocks which are perfectly localized, say, in time, in which case both events will be localized in time with respect to both observers. But this will no longer be the case when we consider things like this, where we consider this is once more the example that I was talking about when I mentioned clocks that interact via their gravitational coupling. In this case, I will describe Alice, one clock, Bob, another clock. They interact gravitationally, and there is Charlie, a faraway guy who is so far away that its interaction is negligible. And I will consider Alice performing some operation on a quantum system, and I want to ask the question, how would Charlie describe this operation? Will this operation look according to Charlie's time localized in time, or will it not? So.
Yeah, I'm sorry if you said this before. Where did the speed of light come into this? Because it's a non-relativistic.
Yes, this is just for simplicity. Here we're considering the non-relativistic limit.
Yes, but you still have a series before.
Ah, okay. Yeah, this comes from, this is like the mass is h over c squared, and this is another mass, h over c squared. Yes. Yes. So let's consider this situation and let's ask what happens when we change to one or the other reference frame. So it's kind of long expressions, but instead of the state with respect to C, here what I'm depicting is just the unitary evolution. So if you remember, we will have a state that is T times some unitary times the initial state of the rest of the systems. Here is the unitary that C sees. This is how C describes time evolution. So as we see, so the important bit is this one. When is the event happening? As we see, it depends on two operators. One is the clock of A, one is the energy of B. So this one we can perhaps prepare a very, very sharply defined state so that this becomes effectively a C number, but this one we cannot. So what this is saying is that the fact that the presence of B's clock and the fact that it is a clock and thereby it is uncertain in energy will have an effect in the temporal localizability of Alice's event according to Charlie. In other words, there is a picture So this is B's clock. This is the wave packet of B's clock in time space. How precise B's clock is, and it has a certain uncertainty sigma, certain width sigma, and this sigma, or 1 over sigma, will be the delocalization or the lack of localizability in time of Alice's event as parameterized by Charlie. So the sharper Bob's clock is localized in time, the better Bob's clock is, the fuzzier the event of Alice will be localized, as seen by Charlie. On the other hand, if we jump into Alice's reference frame, we will see that this is the evolution operator. So there will be, first of all, a shift in the Hamiltonians of B and C according to A due to the fact that her clock is interacting. This was pointed out also by Alex in his talk. But what I want to focus on is what happens to the argument of this f. This f is the function that triggers when the event happens. We see that in this reference frame, for this unitary evolution, which is the evolution that Alice's tracks, this f is depends only on a C number. This means that whenever S becomes TA star, the event happens, and that's it. So it will be sharply localized with respect to Alice's temporal reference frame. So we're seeing, this is kind of probably the key message of this paper, which is whether an event is sharply localized in time or not depends on the temporal reference frame that we are choosing to describe it. And moreover, there seems to be special temporal reference frames that are especially suited for describing certain events. In this case, it's of course very convenient to choose Alice's temporal reference frame to describe her own event, because in this case, what the description of this event is merely the dilation of a CP map or the von Neumann description of a measurement, if you wish, in which is a totally standard quantum mechanical thing. So this means we can choose a reference frame into which the description of an event as seen by something, as described as something that happens to a system, acquires its usual quantum mechanical kind of description. So the last example that I would like to look at is this gravitational quantum switch. I think we have heard about it already in this conference, but I will explain how it goes quickly. So we have two parties, Alice and Bob. There is, say, an external party, Charlie, which describes this experiment from far away. And there is a mass, in this case, the planet Jupiter, which is put either close to Alice, here on the left, or close to Bob, here on the right. Both parties are equipped with clocks, and they both agree to perform some operation on a system controlled by the readings of their clocks. When their clocks say 12 o'clock, they will perform an operation. So we see that if the mass is here, this clock will tick relatively faster as compared to this one, and then one can arrange an experiment such that Bob can signal to Alice. We have a causal ordering of events in which Bob precedes Alice. On the other hand, if we put the mass here, we will have a causal ordering of events in which Alice will be able to signal to Bob. And the idea is, of course, to put Jupiter in a superposition and then have a superposition of both things. So as it turns out, it is possible to give a theoretical description of this experiment in terms of what I was talking about, in terms of this time reference frames framework. And this one is given by this constraint equation, in which phi I is simply the gravitational potential due to the mass. Phi I, according to clock A, it will depend on the distance between A and the mass, or B, the distance between B and the mass, and so on. And of course, this term will also have to appear here, multiplying the F, because it requires some energy to perform an operation on a system. And this will also couple to gravity. So this experiment was came out in this paper, which was published recently. So what do we see? I'm gonna play the same game again. I'm not gonna be so explicit in equations because I think it's already very a bit complicated. But I will draw a picture. When we jump into Charlie's reference frame and when we look at the description of Charlie, of the times at which the events happen, we will be able to draw a picture like this, which is very similar to the picture Lucian drew yesterday on the blackboard when he was discussing change of coordinates. So each of these rectangles depict one space-time manifold. They depict whether the mass is on the right or the mass is on the left. When the mass is on the right, we saw that Alice's event happens before Bob's. And when the mass is on the left, we saw that Bob's event, which is here, happens before Alice's. But these two are, of course, the same event. So this is why we join them by a line. So this event is kind of an identification of these stars between different manifolds. And we see that from the description of Charlie, this would happen at what Charlie would call four different points. Now we will jump to Alice's frame. When we jump to Alice's frame, what we do, so let me try to explain better. We're gonna, by jumping to Alice's frame, what we're gonna do, we said that Alice describes her event sharply according to her clock time. So what's gonna happen here geometrically is when we do this transformation, when we recast this history state in terms of what Alice sees, we're gonna see that this red star goes to this time t star, and this red star goes up to this time t star in such a way that according to Alice, the red event, which is her event, happens sharply in time. Of course, this happens at the expense of Bob's event being delocalized in time with respect to Alice. In one branch, we will have Bob's event happening in the future, and in another branch, we will have Bob's event happening in the past. So this is pretty much points to the fact that we can choose a frame transformation so that the event is sharply localized according to the observer which describes it. And then in this representation, the description of the event, the mathematical description, will be given by kind of a standard quantum mechanical map or dilation of a map.
Why did the C disappear?
So C is not depicted here. You mean in the equation?
In the equation, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't put C, but let's say he factors out everything. He's far away. Yeah. Yes, I didn't put C here, but I think it's not important. He will play kind of a trivial role.
He doesn't factor out.
Okay, so this is pretty much all what I wanted to say. I would like to maybe point out some possible future directions that are important, that I consider important. So all what I was telling here, and in particular this example of the mass being in a superposition between here and here, relies on the assumption of the mass having some sort of semi-classical state. And this is the things that we are superimposing. Can we go beyond this, and can we include in this formulation more general states of the mass? Of course, I focused on temporal reference frames, and I kind of took for granted the spatial aspects of all these experiments. I did this for simplicity, but it would be, of course, very important to include spatial quantum reference frames into the picture. And in general, it would be interesting to explore further the connection of this framework with the formalism of indefinite causal structures, and in particular to figure out what is the connection with Ognian's time delocalized subsystems and Philip and Chaslav's causal reference streams. So, thank you.
In the final example with Jupiter, it seems like there's an assumption that the observers are unaware of where Jupiter is. I mean, the clocks.
Yes.
You know, their clocks are just ticking, and they just think that the clocks are. But in reality, there's going to be a different gravitational field. So isn't there some decoherence that's going to come from the fact that there's extra information about what is actually happening? I mean, I'm not exactly sure how that would come in.
Yeah, I guess one can engineer some sort of experimental situation where this doesn't play a role. Like I don't know, for example, making their wave packet wide enough so that the full translation of the laboratory for the duration of the experiment is irrelevant for this gravitational pull, for example, or
So we did consider that in the paper. So you can make the clocks being in complete free fall and then it still happen. So the best way to think, you can still have the installation by putting a sphere around the clock, and then the gravitational force inside is zero, but then still there is a potential difference between inside and outside.
Sure.
And you can, of course, the technology
application. From Jupiter,
though. Yeah, this would be an empty Jupiter. It's
a hollow Jupiter.
And there's a superposition between being small and large.
Sure. Okay.
There's a question at the back.
Yes. Your constraint equations are real, which means quantum mechanics is their Hermitian. So if you have solutions e to the I omega t where the clock is going in some sense in the four directions, you also have solutions where the clock is going backwards. Is that correct?
I don't think we found solutions with the clock going backwards.
But if they have any constraints, In recent cases in relativistic physics, when one studies things like that, the constraints are always real, classically, in their position. And you do always have matching of solutions with frequency, classical frequency matching.
Okay. I think not in this case, but I
hear that the constraint is linear in the clock Hamiltonian. So in the relativistic systems, it would be quadratic.
Ah, okay.
And there
yeah.
you get a positive and negative frequencies and stuff like that.
Okay, so are you interested in those cases? Presumably the generic state, maybe it's not relevant to the case you showed us, but we all think that they should be relativistic, of course.
Yes.
So
yes.
The relativistic cases. The generic state is the position of the clock going backwards and the clock going forward with arbitrary coefficients. since it's real and it sounds, which is the second. So you have, is that to cause a problem for the interpretation of these things?
I wouldn't think so. I think the way I would do it in such a case is just to pick one of these, like forward or backward, and define what I mean by events and time evolution with respect to each of them, which won't talk to each other, I think. And
you might worry that putting in interactions would take a state which was purely positive frequency and add negative frequency.
Isn't that solved already in ordinary quantum field theory? You just interpret negative frequencies as antiparticles. I mean, it's never A in the negative field, and it's everything, time is always going forward. It just, it's one is a creation, one an annihilation operator. So I'm not sure if, I mean, this is just something of, say, the Klein-Gordon equation, but somehow we have solved that problem already, no?
No.
Why not? That's
why we did quantum field.
Right, so quantum field theory solves the problem, so you just have to treat the clocks as quantum fields in that case.
That's a big adjust.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
huh?
It's a big adjust.
It's a big adjust? But I mean, from the point of view of the formalism, there are not any different operators or observable or quantum state. It's still Hilbert space and operator, so what's the fundamental difference?
Well, why don't we discuss this later? It seems to me, if your way out is to have an arbitrary infinite number of clocks and anti-clocks, you're in the domain, you've got a host of technical issues and conceptual issues.
Yep. Just to say, this is meant to be a toy model to really explore the temporal localizability of events. So we choose the kind of easiest possible. But
sure. And it's very interesting.
Can you just show the general state that you were showing for from the point of view of C, the Gibbs state with relative to C's clock?
That's for the switch?
Yeah, here, this one. Yeah. So is it correct that the procedure to go to one clock or another is by this relative state in this?
So there is a procedure to go from one clock to the other.
Does it agree with the relative state picture? I just, looking at the global state, I look at this clock and that's what I see, or I look at that clock and that's what I see, or is it something more complicated?
It's like a change of variables. I don't know exactly what you mean, but if you can, so one way you can do it is just take the constraint, exponentiate it, and build what they call this coherent averaging. You do that, and you work out how the state looks like, and then from there you manipulate. We can talk about it. You manipulate the equation such that you can either jump into C or jump into A by kind of factoring out all what depends on A and C and leaving on the other side of this kind of tensor product what depends on the rest of the systems. That is not there is a way to do it. This is like a.
But this is the constraint state, right?
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, it is a constraint state. Yes.
I had a question. So here you're defining, like, your notion of event is has to do with, I think, as I understand this, it's like the clock interacting with something. Is that, and that gives you a notion of an event. And I understand this, like, we want the coincidence of things or something like this to coincide with an event, but it also seems...
Is this, yeah.
Yeah. But it also seems to me that we could just say, like, I mean, I don't have to include the notion of event in the constraint. I could say instead that here's my system or whatever, and my event is going to be the clock reading this value in the system doing something else, some kind of, like, statement like that. So I'm just like, what are the advantages of including it in the constraint or something? Like, are those the only two events that happened in the whole constraint, or?
The two operationally defined events.
Yes.
So
those the only events that are encoded in the...
Yeah, so the way I look at this equation is not kind of expressing the evolution of the whole universe or the history of all degrees of freedom or anything like that. It's just describing an experiment. And if I want to change the experiment, I change the constraint. and I would put different deltas depending on what I want to describe. And I consider to be free to choose the different k's that I will put and the different TA stars and TB stars at will if I want to describe a different experiment.
But if there's no delayed choice experiment that can be made. So if you have to decide at the very beginning at what times you'll measure, and then you have the whole evolution, and then you can change those decisions, right?
Yes.
So you kind of...
I mean, this is interpretational. I would say any delayed choice experiment can be also cast in this form.
Really?
Yes, I think so. This is basically all what quantum mechanics is. It's just the way of calculating is slightly different.
But that's dependent on your will, right, in that case.
Yeah, but importantly, my will is able to change the Hamiltonian.
That would be nice.
Yes.
Model of a soul.
Okay. Nice, I've got a question. So, yeah, it's about the state. For the gravitational quantum switch side. I was curious about, so there's no, if you go from this state from the perspective of C,
yes,
this one to the perspective of A, but here it doesn't seem there's any Hilbert, even like relative Hilbert spaces of like C from, no, A from the perspective of C or B from the perspective of C. So I'm curious about, how you change the perspective of A. Because you do have, if it's position, you'd have relative position between C and B, and you can see how you switch the perspective of A by refactoring.
Yeah, this is actually formally very similar to the case of space, where you impose like kind of a momentum constraint. But there is a difference in which this refactorization doesn't happen for the case of time. And the reason why it doesn't happen is that for the case of space, you would like to kind of really factor out one of the parties. And for this, you have to apply this unitary operator that is, I think, what you call the refactorization.
Yes.
Whereas here we're interested in describing kind of the temporal development of things with respect to the clock. So you don't really want to factor out the clock. You want the clock to monitor the state at different times. So this operator, you kind of just don't, you don't apply it, actually. And this is the difference between time and space, somehow.
Okay, maybe I'll ask.
We can talk about the,
I think the, snacks have been put out about 1 minute ago, so we should probably head down now. And we'll start you again at 20 past, is it?
Yeah.